you know, they got him dead to rights. It's like, it's crazy. He's got nothing.
Welcome to Politicology. I'm Ron Steslow. Last week, for the first time in American history, a former president was indicted on federal criminal charges. After Donald Trump was indicted over his mishandling of classified documents, he kept after leaving office and then obstructing the government's efforts to reclaim them. So it's about time we took a deeper look at the indictment, the historical significance of these charges, the complex political and legal dynamics, and there's nobody better to unpack all of this with than my friend George Conway. George is a conservative attorney, my fellow Lincoln Project co-founder, whose pontifications, quips, and corgis can be frequently found in a number of outlets and most frequently on Twitter. He's also a graduate of Harvard and Yale Law School. George, so good to be with you.
How are you?
I'm doing great. All right. It's nice to be in studio again.
Yeah. Happy second arraignment day.
It's a big day.
It is a big day. It's a historic day.
It's a historic day and feels like it's been such a long time coming.
It has been a long time coming.
I don't know about you, but the first indictment felt so anticlimactic.
It wasn't the one you expected, and it wasn't the blockbuster one. Yeah. It was sort of, this is something that should have been charged by the feds a long time ago, and it's really, we've seen so much since. So yeah, I know it was just the warm-up act.
Wyndham Hotels and Resorts makes travel possible for all. Whether it's the long haulers looking for a great cup of coffee, a roomier rest for the on a whim road trippers, or a place to make summer memories with the whole family. No matter who you are, where you're going, or why, with 24 trusted brands to choose from like La Quinta, Days Inn, and Super 8, your Wyndham is waiting. Get the lowest price at WyndhamHotels.com. Restrictions apply. Visit website for more details.
All right. So before we get into the details of the charges and then compare, contrast Biden, Pence documents, et cetera, first let's just take a minute to do some zoom out, some stage setting about the historical context this is happening in, because it hasn't happened before in American history.
Right.
Not only the charges, but also the political dynamics that were, you know, they're gearing up for in 2024. So why don't we start with the indictment and the documents case and talk a little bit about the historical significance of a former president facing federal charges.
Well, it's never happened before. It absolutely is unprecedented. He's the only president ever to have been indicted in a state court. Now he's the only president ever to have been indicted in a federal court. I think it's the most significant, just in terms of historical and in a political sense, the most significant federal prosecution perhaps since the 1803 or 1804, I forget what year it was, prosecution of Aaron Burr for treason. I can't think of anything quite like it. I mean, you know, there have been lots of big trials in American history, Sacco Vanzetti, Rosenberg's, a great moment, but, you know, none involving accountability for a criminal president. And we had some presidents who, you know, kind of went to that line. Nixon managed to skate and, you know, because Ford pardoned him and he committed obstruction of justice. But when you look back at what he did or the evidence against him, it really is just nothing compared to what they have on Trump. I mean, this famous smoking gun tape that came out when the tapes were released and Nixon had lost the tapes case in the Supreme Court, which basically had him almost musing, like they were explaining to him what was going on with the cover-up and you know, they were doing the cover-up, the minions, three levels below him, and they were explaining, like, you know, these guys need money and so on. Well, we could get that. And then he said something like, well, we could have the CIA tell the FBI to back off the investigation. And that was the smoking gun line that took Nixon down, that caused Hugh Scott and all the Republicans to go up to the White House and say, Mr. President, your support in Congress has collapsed. You will be impeached and removed from office. It wasn't this where he's personally directing right. the moving of documents and directing the issuance of false statements. It was almost like he was just throwing that out.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I have to go back to the tape and listen. It wasn't clear that he was ordering anybody to actually do that. But
it was more evidence that he
knew about the cover up and was tolerating it and, you know, just making suggestions about it, but not really directing it. Here, Trump is in the bowels of this. I mean, it's as though he were himself at the Watergate taking a roll of electrical tape and taping that door open in the garage. I mean, it's not fun. No, seriously. He was with the plumbers. In fact, there were two plumbers. There was the plumbers here were Trump and Walt Nauta. That's it.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's why the evidence is so powerful, is that his hands were caught in the cookie jar. And not only that, it's on video, it's on audio, he's got his lawyer, he's got admitting to his lawyers and admitting on tape that he had the cookies and his hands were in the jar. It's really quite remarkable. I mean, the evidence that they have against him. If you go to any page in that indictment and you just throw a dart and you hit an allegation that probably is enough by itself to put him in prison. And it's like every page is like that. It's just that's how incredible this indictment is. And it tells a clear story. It's a simple story. I mean, this is, in a way, it's a big white collar case and a big political corruption case. But usually there's some ambiguity in there about, you know, well, was the money for that or was the money for this or something? It's like there's no ambiguity here. I mean, this is like a nickel and dime drug bust caught on tape by the FBI or the DEA on a street corner in Manhattan. You see high def, you see who the perp is, and you see the bag of crack or whatever the hell it is, and then they seize the crack and they have the crack and it was in his possession, and they got him dead to rights. It's like it's crazy. How strong the evidence is here.
Okay, so we'll get into the charges, we'll get into the evidence in a minute, but I think the other piece of this is it's funny because I had some friends texting me, is this good or bad? And I was like, for who? Like, I mean, for him, obviously very bad. And then they said, no, for the country. And I said, ooh.
My view is, you know, people say, oh, it's a sad day for the country, it's a bad day for the country. Yeah, it is and it isn't.
Well, let's be clear. Let's be clear for people following along. The thing that is bad for the country, arguably, happened. However, we now, in addition to the unprecedented nature of the charges of a former president, there's also the unprecedented political dynamic of a sitting president prosecuting a former president during a presidential campaign where they're running against each other.
The truly bad thing isn't that he's being brought to justice and being held accountable.
It's good for the rule of law.
And the indictment. The bad thing was we had a president who was a brazen criminal who squirreled away these documents, who cavalierly maintained them in a fashion that made them completely insecure, even though these documents were things that foreign powers would engage in a great deal of effort and spend money to get. You know, the bad thing was we had a president who tried to install himself as permanent president for life in a self coup. That's what's bad. I mean, what would be worse, the worst thing that could possibly have happened for the country is for the guy to be given a pass on this. I mean, you just cannot. There is nothing. This guy has basically breached his duties in such an incomprehensibly vile way that we can't let this go. It cannot be in any way condoned or accepted or be allowed to pass. So that's my
totally opinion. Agree. All right, let's turn to the indictment and walk through what's in it. What are the allegations here for what Trump did and how do they contribute to the charges? And I think, let's walk through that first, and then we'll get to the difference between the Biden-Pence stuff. But first and foremost, what is Trump being charged with?
No, he's being charged with principally, like for 31 counts or so, he's being charged with a violation of a provision of the Espionage Act, not not for espionage as it is traditionally defined, but the Espionage Act has a bunch of provisions in it that cover things that relate to espionage or that enable espionage. And one of them is that if you are in the possession of, I forget the exact language in, I think it's 793 C or E of Title 18 U.S. Code. If you are in the possession of national defense information that can be used against to harm the country, sensitive national defense information, and I'm paraphrasing there, and you are requested by an appropriate government authority to give that information back, and you do not give that information back, you have committed a felony punishable by up to 10 years in a federal penitentiary. And that's essentially, that's what he did. He refused again and again. And you don't have to, for purposes of that provision, which he's been charged with 31 times, you do not, the information doesn't even have to be technically classified, because the Espionage Act was something that was enacted, I guess, probably around World War I, before the, you know, they got fancy, fancy
all these different classifications.
Fancy abbreviations and whatnot, and new, you know, no foreign and all that stuff, whatever. You know, the NatSec people love their abbreviations. And it doesn't matter. It's just, is this stuff valuable defense information? Yeah. And, you know, this is the stuff that goes to the President of the United States that they make numbered copies of that, you know, should never see the light of day. They should never have left the White House. They should never have left a skiff. And I think the Oval Office is considered like a skiff, kind of a little bit.
Yeah, skiff, secure, compartmentalized information.
Right. They are not supposed to be taken home, even if you are still a sitting public official. They're certainly not meant to be taken by a former official to a beach house or hotel and shoved in a bathroom and, you know, in unmarked boxes that anybody can rifle through. I mean, it's insane.
Yeah.
That's mostly what the charges are. There are a bunch of obstruction charges under different federal statutes and a conspiracy to obstruct. And that basically they have to show that he acted intentionally in a corrupt fashion or by lying to impede the investigation in some way. I mean, that's the base concept of obstruction. And they're very, I don't remember the different, there are some different statutes that they use here, including just the straight obstruction statute. But I mean, he did that too. There's no question he did that. I mean, we have evidence of his personal valet moving the documents around shortly before the feds were to come to get the documents. Yeah. And you have him suggesting to his lawyer, who then puts it in a recording, that wouldn't it be just better if we just tell them we don't have anything and, you know, lie to them? And then when they did come with a subpoena, he didn't produce all the documents. And then he told his lawyers to certify that all the documents had been produced. And then lo and behold, when they issued the search warrant and executed it, there were still documents there. I mean, the evidence of criminal intent is just overwhelming. I just don't see how any rational juror, rational trier of fact could find him not to have had the criminal intent to conceal and to withhold these documents, and certainly the intent to not produce them in response to the request, which is a straight out violation of the Espionage Act.
That part seems to be potentially more potent piece of this prosecution.
They have him dead to rights. They have him dead to rights. I mean, the thing that they did not charge him with was simply having the documents.
Right. We've got other cases where
He had these documents. He shouldn't have taken them. There was a huge number of documents. I don't know how many boxes, 100 plus boxes, and thousands of pages of documents. And we saw that, right. And he took, you know, he had them shipped to Mar-a-Lago. And if in May of 2021, when NARA, the National Archives and Records Administration, first began knocking on the door and saying, hey, we think you might have some documents with you. Could you take a look? If he had said, come on down, and he had just turned them all over and said, here, you look wherever you want, and they had gotten all the documents, and we certainly would not be sitting here talking about the second indictment of a federal indictment of Donald Trump. And we might not have even heard about it. I mean, there might have been a news story at some point that there was an investigation into this, but it would have been closed.
So it's the obstruction of the government's efforts to get them back that is really, really
right. And the jerking around, I mean, the refusal to give it back. Right. And then there is outright obstruction, the jerking the government around, which is refusing to give it back, which is the Espionage Act claim, and then the lying and cheating about it and the squirreling them around and such.
Okay. So
pretty bad stuff.
Yeah, pretty bad stuff. So the question here is, do they have to prove the Espionage Act stuff in order to get them on the obstruction?
No, but they go hand in hand.
Sure.
I mean, the bottom line is what they have to prove overall in this case was he had the stuff. He knew he had the stuff. Mm-hmm. They asked for the stuff back. He didn't get the stuff back. And then he lied and hid the stuff. As they're trying to get it back. Lied or hid the stuff. Well, those all go together here.
Sure.
It's not a complex story. It's like, it is just not a complex story. And it all falls and rises together because it was all one thing. He tried to keep the stuff and he wanted to keep it secret. And it's just all those crimes, obstruction and the unlawful retention, go together. Yeah. But again, he would not, if he had just simply taking the stuff and holding it, if he had just said, oh, I have the stuff, you're right, sorry. That there would have been no harm, no foul, and he would have gotten off, I think everyone believes, because certainly he wasn't charged with anything that suggests that they would have charged him with that. I mean, and that's why the Pence and Biden cases, which you alluded to earlier, are distinguishable as far as we can tell. Pence has already gotten a pass, and I presume that's because, based on the reported facts that we know, he voluntarily turn some stuff over. I guess it must have occurred to him that, well,
as everybody else is finding right, documents
it's like,
in their,
you know,
closets,
it's like, wait, I better check mine, which was kind of conscientious of him. I mean, he could have just taken the position, I really don't want to know. Right. But I think he wisely said, you know, it's possible, and he had somebody take a look, because the last thing he'd want would be 6 months from now or a year from now to for this stuff to pop up. Right. And then they'd say, well, why didn't you take a look when this other thing happened? You know, it was a very, very, you know,
he's got to distinguish himself from the guy he's running against.
It's also just sort of the honest person's thing. It's the Boy Scout thing to do, which, you know,
a lot of reasons to do it.
Correct. It's not, you know,
it's the law.
it was the Boy Scout. I mean, he could have probably taken the position, I don't really know and I don't want to look.
Yeah.
And still not, but he went that extra step, and that just shows his innocent state of mind. And then the Biden stuff, I mean, unless there's some
evidence. A Corvette's not much better than a bathroom.
It ain't great, but
He also knew about it before the midterms and then sat on it for a while.
Yeah, but again, he cooperated with the investigation. He gave the stuff back. He didn't lie about it. Yeah. So as far as we know. If he did, then he may be in the same category, but I can't imagine he would be in the same order of magnitude.
Right.
And then you have the Hillary Clinton case, which...
So that one, so just to pause on Biden for a second, that one has not been charged. We don't know if it will be charged.
We don't know. It's being...
But there is a special prosecutor.
There is an investigation going on, and we don't know that it will be charged. But, you know, it's just... So far, we haven't heard any bombshells about it that really put it in the Trump category. I mean, the Trump saga is just that it went on for so long, and there was so much deception and so much effort to conceal that it's just
up to the very last.
Up to the
minute.
Very last.
Yeah.
And maybe to this day, I mean, the government still believes, apparently, and they've told, I think they told the U.S. District Court in the District of Columbia, the judge presiding over the grand jury, I think they told her that they believe that there are still some documents missing, you know, and with him, anything's possible.
With him, anything's possible. Yeah. I mean, it doesn't feel great to have the presumptive nominees of both major political parties under investigation for not in the same ballpark, but in the, you know,
no, it's not great. But Trump's conduct was so egregious. If it had been allowed to pass and just say, well, we can't do anything because he was former president, you're basically just saying the president is above the law. And you're saying the president is above the law in regard to, you know, obeying the rules that are designed to protect our military, our intelligence sources, and protect the security of the country.
Yeah. So there's a tape. Last week, CNN reported that they obtained a transcript of a taped conversation Trump had in 2021.
Quite remarkable.
Yeah, he was recorded discussing a classified Pentagon document about attacking Iran.
Right.
And in this recording, he acknowledged that the document contained classified information that he could have declassified.
But did not.
While he was in office, but had not.
Correct.
This is what he said on the tape.
On the tape.
And
he can hear the paper rustling. I mean, there's some question as to what the document actually was and its provenance. I mean, that he may have been blowing smoke about what was actually in the document, but this just shows
the significance of what he's saying.
The significance is that, you know, I know I have classified stuff. I know I didn't declassify it. I didn't declassify it, and I know that you shouldn't look at this because it's still secret.
Maybe that was and
when he's doing that, he's in a conference room or somewhere in Bedminster, New Jersey, at his own golf club, not in a U.S. government facility, and he's no longer president of the United States. So he had no business possessing it. And there's even a line in the recording where he says, I can't show this to you. And he goes, oh, we could be in trouble or something. That somebody says we could be in trouble that could be a problem.
That could be a problem.
It's like, yeah. I mean, obviously so. And they're just treating it like it's some kind of a joke.
Problem doing a lot of work.
It's
in
incredible. Yeah. You just.
Yeah.
Just can't make it up.
So this case is going to be tried in the federal district court in Florida, not in D.C., federal district
Correct.
Court in Florida, being known as the Rocket Docket because of the speed with which
one of those districts known as a Rocket Docket. Eastern District of Virginia is one too.
Which means they move really quickly.
Yes,
right?
We hope.
Do you think,
for the sake of the country.
Right, for the sake of the country. What impact do you think that's going to have on the case? Do you think it will indeed proceed?
Here's part of the venue
issue, right? In D.C., people should recognize one serious concern prosecutors have is that he can make a legitimate claim that he can't get a fair trial here in D.C. because of the politics.
I disagree with that. Okay. But, I mean, I think that's what he would make that argument.
Right. And certainly, I think it's fair.
I mean, the problem he has in the District of Columbia is the fact that the District of Columbia is the most educated venue in the United States. I mean, it has, you know, the highest percentage of people with advanced degrees, and they're going to understand this.
Sure.
And they're not going to be able to blow smoke. But I don't think...
But if you're pulling a jury from D.C., it's like 90% Democrats.
So, right. Well, so. I mean, there's a core, you know, I mean, we love highly educated people.
Yes.
Or poorly, I don't know. But there's a correlation there. And sadly, there's a correlation there. And the Republican Party has become the party of you know, basically feigned or intentional or actual ignorance. But so, you know, it's a bad venue for him. But the Constitution, the Sixth Amendment, says that a criminal defendant is entitled to a jury from the district and from the state and the district in which the alleged crime was committed. And basically all this stuff happened in Mar-a-Lago. So it actually, I mean, some people were surprised. A lot of people were surprised at the case being brought in Florida. And I think that was because so much of the grand jury work and the investigation was done out of D.C. and the falsehoods were directed at an investigation that was being run out of the records, the archives had been department and the Justice Department. But the fact is that the obstructive act, concealing the moving the documents around, happened in the Southern District of Florida, West Palm Beach Division.
Okay.
So that's why the case is in Florida. Now the question is, you know, a judge. Now the Rocket Docket aspect of it is good, but you know, it's really all up to the individual judge. The individual judge has not quite unlimited, but very close to it, just the discretion about the timing of proceedings.
Yeah.
I mean, the statute requires and the Constitution requires that
defendants get a speedy trial, but of this, and there's a something called the Speedy Trial Act that basically sets off this clock that requires a trial to be held within a certain amount of time after charges are brought. But defendants can waive that. And this defendant, of course, and a lot of defendants want to delay proceedings. And sometimes the prosecutors kind of allow it because they're busy too and they need to put their case together and they're understaffed. Yeah. Here, they're not going to do that. The defense is going to try to put things off. And, you know, the judge, depending on how, what the alacrity with which a judge responds to pretrial motions that are either could delay things or they could be legitimate motions that take time. And it's like, you know, if you have a judge who's handled stuff like this before, like these judges here in the District of Columbia who have handled lots of documents, classified documents cases and espionage cases and whatnot, and their experience with the rules that have to be applied, the special rules that have to be applied to the presentation of classified information in court, you know, you can move quite fast. If you have a judge like the judge who handled the E. Jean Carroll case in New York, who's just smart and good and not taking any gruff, you can move a case along quite well. And I think this case is simple enough that you could probably try it within a good judge. If you like had, you know, Andrew Weissman J or something right. This case would go to trial in 9 to 12 months and it would be a good thing. I mean, the defendant would get his day in court, the defendant would get his discovery, the defendant would get all the things he is entitled to, and the country would get a resolution, which is really, really absolutely the critical thing
here. Desperately need, yeah. So we'll get to some of those pretrial
motions. But that said, you know, we've got this judge, and we don't know what she's going
to
do.
Yeah, and I want to get to the judge in a minute, too, because Judge Eileen Cannon, that name should ring a bell for people. We've talked about her recently. Is there a political difference if a jury of Floridians finds Trump guilty versus a jury in D.C.?
Well, I think that's right. I think that's a very good point. And I think that...
Not that politics should interfere with the rule of
law. No, it shouldn't. But in terms of, in terms of presenting it, the historical record and going back and saying, you know, it's just saying you won't be able to say, oh, this was a jury of Democrats and this was a jury of liberal people who work for the government in the District of Columbia and Byron's. You know, this is it was a jury of a very divided state with blue and red divided state. Now that said, I don't think the makeup of the jury is as outcome determinative as some people think it may be. And I think to illustrate that point, I'd go back to the Jean Carroll case. The Jean Carroll case, yes, the case was tried in Manhattan in the Southern District of New York, but the Southern District of New York, the federal district that's called the Southern District of New York, includes not only New York, which is Manhattan, and Bronx counties. It includes Westchester County, which is suburban and elects Republicans from time to time. I mean, that's where Jeanine Pirro was the district attorney. And Orange and Putnam and Rockland counties, and those have a fair number. Those are
Republicans in Rockland County.
There are absolutely. Yeah. You will drive 15, 20 miles north of New York City, cross the Hudson, and you're going to see some pickup trucks with MAGA signs.
Just up in the Catskills.
Absolutely. You're going to get in the E. Jean Carroll case, there were a number of jurors who were not from Manhattan and Bronx. There was even a fellow who told the court and the lawyers and the voir dire before getting picked for the jury that he got all of his news from a podcast by some fellow named Tim Pool, who is some kind of a right-wing nut job and conspiracy theorist. And the lawyers didn't quite figure it out. They didn't catch the reference to Pool, and it was mistranscribed in the transcript. They didn't catch it till like 2 days into the trial, and they tried to get rid of him. But it turned out, you know, this guy, along with the rest of the other eight jurors, returned a $5 million verdict for Jean Carroll, basically in 2 or 3 hours while having lunch. And he had no problem with it, and he went home, he did the right thing. And so I have hope, and maybe this is a rose-colored glasses view or maybe I'm just over-optimistic, but I do think the jurors, and lawyers will tell you that jurors do try to put their biases away because they see they're in a They're in a special place, a federal courtroom. They have a federal judge there. They have the flag. They have it. It's a very solemn proceeding. It's a very serious thing. And it's an honor and a privilege and a great responsibility to participate in this process.
And certainly this jury is going to understand the gravity that they've been charged with. They're just going to know that going in.
And they are not, you know.
History's on their shoulders. Right.
And they don't have, you know, it's not like listening to Fox News or even listening to me on the TV or here. You know, this is done by the book, by the rules. You can't bullshit your way through a criminal trial before a good federal judge the way these people can avoid questions on Meet the Press or whatnot.
Let's talk for a minute about the defense.
There is no defense.
Well, let's talk about the pretrial motions.
Yes.
Because that's what I think is going to constitute the majority. It's going to be procedural, right?
Right.
So they've got... Trump's former attorney, Timothy Parlatore, spoke to Political Playbook, and this morning I read a bit about how he'd handle the early stages of the case. It basically comes down to...
Why he's talking to the press is just beyond me.
Well, he couldn't... the reason he left the legal defense team was because he couldn't actually get messages to Trump himself.
I understand but it's just... I mean, even Trump is entitled to lawyers who don't blab to the media.
Yeah, fair. So...
Maybe he's not.
So you've got a few potential things here. One is to first pursue aggressive discovery to craft alternative explanations in response to the government's case. The second is to probe prosecutorial misconduct, in particular an allegation from Trump's team that the Justice Department's counterintelligence chief pressured Trump's body man and co-defendant, Nauta, during an interview by mentioning that his attorney had applied for a D.C. Superior Court judgeship. There's that. And then third is to attack the search warrant, which is, you know, to suppress the evidence found during the Mar-a-Lago search last summer. There's also get Trump lawyer Evan Corcoran's notes excluded because Judge Amy Berman Jackson here in D.C. allowed the special counsel to pierce attorney client privilege using the crime fraud exception, which is a big deal. And the indictment relied a lot on those notes to establish key parts of the obstruction components. Then you've got attack the process to get the indictment. Parlatore alleges that during the grand jury process, prosecutors repeatedly asked about privileged attorney-client communications and then argued to jurors that invoking that privilege was evidence of guilt. And then last but not least, he said the strategy was to attack the entire investigation and kill the case using a death by a thousand cuts. So, of that constellation of approaches, do you think any of them will be effective, could be effective pretrial, and why not?
I mean, they got nothing.
Okay.
I mean, let's go through it one by one.
Sure.
What's the first one we get?
Let's pursue aggressive discovery come up with a different narrative.
There's no other narrative.
Okay.
We've been sitting here for 9 months listening for them to come up with another narrative. There is no narrative. And in terms of what the discovery is, what are they going to discover? The government's just going to dump all these documents, all of its evidence out and give it to them. They've already got it together.
But they can get communication that was not in the indictment. So let's zoom out. Tell me if this is wrong or not.
Right.
Is it fair to say that, especially in an indictment like this, the government's strongest case is usually at its best in the indictment?
Yes.
And then it is from there...
that could be the case, but I think the opposite is true here. I think, you know, this was given the amount of evidence that they have, this was a pretty concise pleading. I'm sure they could have had a 500-page indictment if they wanted to. I think this is just the tip of the iceberg.
It's very dense.
Yes. Yeah. And you know, it's very dense and very, I just don't think, I mean, I don't see what the possible narrative is, unless all of the evidence that we've seen thus far, including the evidence that was revealed in the search warrant affidavit that was filed in August of last year, is falsified. And there's no reason to believe that. That's the first point. And the second point was, let's go back to your points.
Yeah, the second one is, I mean, stemming from that, probe prosecutorial misconduct. Yeah, so if they come up with some kind of leads and discovery that suggests that there has been misconduct on the prosecution side.
It is virtually impossible to get an indictment thrown out for prosecutorial misconduct unless it really involves something like where they were like stealing materials without probable cause.
Sure.
This whole thing about Bratt mentioning that Nauta's lawyer was applying for a DC Superior Court judgeship. I don't know why he brought that up and why it was mentioned, but there's no reason to believe that fellow Bratt had any influence on who gets Superior Court judgeships in the District of Columbia. And there was no evidence that he was making some actual or credible threat against Nauta's attorney. And that all that being said, Nauta didn't plead anyway. Okay. And so what's their point? I mean, Nauta made a big mistake. Nauta should have pleaded. Yeah. Nauta now is out there hanging out there with Trump by himself. And there's so much evidence against Trump that they don't really need to flip Nauta, yeah. Even though they probably would have wanted to. I mean, I, if they took a deal from him today, he's not going to get a great deal because they don't really need him. So okay. That's really, you know, they got nothing there. The search warrant. The search warrant, there's just that was approved by a United States magistrate judge who found that the facts laid out by the FBI in the search warrant affidavit, the affidavit that accompanied the application for a search warrant, there is probable cause. It just means you have to have, like, you know, a reason to believe.
We tried to get it back. He wouldn't give it back. We gotta go get it.
They've never identified anything in the affidavit that was untrue. And when you read that affidavit, it's just, they had every reason to search. Yeah. They had a probable cause to search those premises at that time for those documents. They had way more than probable cause. And I remember thinking at the time, it's like, wow, they got this guy dead to rights. Yeah. So I don't see how they can exclude the documents there. And then I don't know what other, you know, the notion that something before the grand jury, I forget what you said.
Yeah, this one's interesting to me. He said he would get Trump lawyer Evan Corcoran's notes excluded.
Yeah, but
this is about piercing attorney-client privilege. So how do you,
it's very hard. It's a big deal.
Can you explain
deal.
That though?
It is, right.
The crime fraud exception, what is that?
Like normally, you know, if you retain me as a lawyer,
yes.
Even if you're just consulting me to find a lawyer.
And everything we talk about is confidential.
Correct. And not only just confidential, not only do I as an attorney have an ethical obligation and a legal obligation to maintain the privacy and the confidentiality of what you tell me and the advice I give you, I cannot be compelled ordinarily by anybody.
Even a judge.
Even a judge or even a grand jury or whatnot to divulge that information, and judges respect that, and that's an absolute sacrosanct.
It's essential to a functioning sacrosanct system.
To an adversarial judicial system. Absolutely, it is, because you need people to be able to tell the straight scoop to their lawyers and get proper legal advice, and it helps it helps the adversarial process. It's critical, and it helps people vindicate their rights.
So in this case, what happened?
But there is an exception.
Okay.
If you are seeking the advice of an attorney in order to facilitate or to carry out a crime or a fraud, and that's shown by a preponderance of the evidence, that privilege goes away. And they, you know, the evidence here was he was using his lawyers to deceive the government. He was suggesting to his lawyers at one point, according to Corcoran, that they lie to the government and say, "Hey, we don't have any stuff here. What stuff? We don't have any stuff." And then he did lie to the government, you know, after they gave a false certification after the subpoena, after they returned some documents pursuant to the subpoena, they gave a false representation that there was an adequate search conducted and that these were all the documents, and they just weren't. So, you know, and that and so much other evidence, and there's evidence of he was telling people they should look through the documents and pluck the bad stuff out. And yeah, I mean, it's just overwhelming. You just don't see that kind of evidence. And
it's very unusual for this judge privilege to be pierced.
Correct. And
apparently there is a 90 plus page opinion, I think 90 yeah. or something, that is still under seal. We won't see it till someday. Someday we'll see it about by the former chief judge, Judge Beryl Howell of the United States District Court for District of Columbia, who was presiding over all of these grand jury disputes in her capacity as chief judge. She wrote this long opinion explaining why the privilege went away. And I just don't see, and it went up to the Court of Appeals of the District of Columbia Circuit. They tried to stop her order from being carried out. And a three-judge panel, including at least one, maybe two Republican judges, Trump appointees, didn't give it the time of day because presumably they looked at the judge's opinion and said, wow, yeah. look at all that. And basically they disposed of the appeal in about, I don't know, 24 or 36 hours. It was really fast. So
the principle that's
litigate. They could try to relitigate that. But, yeah. I mean, Judge Howell, is just an extremely, she's a very competent judge and she was very well respected and she dots her I's and crosses her T's. And I just don't see how they're going to attack that. Maybe this Judge Cannon will find some way, but I think she'll just get slammed again like she did the first time around.
So the reason we're talking about all of these pretrial motions and the focus on procedure is because the substance of the indictment is so damning, mm-hmm. right? So they're only possible maneuver here.
Their only possible is to fuck with the process, to delay.
And to call into question.
He's got two plays in there, and they're like, we have seen this playbook before from Donald J. Trump. One is to delay. That's his classic litigation strategy, civil and criminal, is to slow things down, take interlocutory appeals, ask for continuances, ask for more time to submit papers, and just do that ad infinitum. And sometimes that has worked in the past. I mean, it worked.
He has a knack for getting out of things.
Well, yeah, no, he's been refining these methods for decades because he has been an individual who has been in legal scrapes basically from the beginning of his adult professional life. That's one. And the other is basically he's calling for violence and jury nullification. And, you know, by saying, oh, people are very angry. I know you're all very upset. You shouldn't commit violence.
I've been waiting for an impression.
No one should commit violence, but people are very, 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 very angry at what's being done to me because what's being done to me is destroying the country and it's being done to you.
They're not really after me. They're after you.
They're after you. And you can't fault people for being mad and wanting to fight back. And we need to fight back to take our country. And, you know, same playbook from January 6th.
So correct. Ugly.
It's quite scary. I mean, on the plus side is that these people are stupid and disorganized.
He's still scrambling for a lawyer as of today. He doesn't have a lead defense.
We think
counsel.
He does not have. Yeah, he has a problem because all of the he has always gone through lots of lawyers. Remember, he had this clown show for the second impeachment trial. A couple of reasons is he's nuts. he doesn't follow legal advice. He shops for legal advice.
He uses his lawyers to commit crimes, which are not supposed to do.
He gets his lawyers into trouble, and then he doesn't pay them. Right. And you know, he'll even shop for legal advice from people who aren't lawyers. I mean, part of the reason why he's in this mess is he was convinced, or allegedly, by Tom Fitton, who runs this legal organization called Judicial Watch, but who is himself not a lawyer. He got this some cockamamie theory from this guy who doesn't know anything about law and didn't read an opinion in a case that his own organization lost that said that he could do whatever he wanted to these documents on the Presidential Records Act. The Presidential Records Act says exactly the opposite. Presidential Records Act says these documents belong to the United States of America and they revert to the control of NARA at noon on January 20th, 2021. So he's got nothing. I mean, he really has no, but that said, I mean, you know, there's going to be some litigation about how you handle these documents because they're classified. There are specific provisions in the statute called the Classified Information Protection Act that are very complex and that require some expertise. And so what happened with him, with his lawyers is that he made them all witnesses. And there's something called the lawyer witness rule that says that if you are a witness in a case, you cannot be an advocate in the case. So all of these people who he tried to get to lie to the government, or he told, he made these admissions to, like Corcoran, who made these extensive notes that the government put to good use in the indictment. These, you know, Alina Haba, they're all witnesses. And to some extent, they have been exposed to potential criminal liability because they were conveying false information from Donald Trump to the government. You know, I think Alina Haba issued that certification that said all the documents were produced. And although she put a little caveat there because she knew that, you know, she was treading on thin ice. And, but, you know, the point is that the information that was given to her that was false was given to her by him. And that's why the attorney-client privilege appears. And that's why she's a witness. And that's why she can't, even though she's not competent to anyway, represent Trump. And then they've got the problem of morale with these lawyers, the two lawyers that they have had who are actually halfway competent, resigned, three of them resigned in a matter of weeks, two on the day the indictment was unsealed. So he's got between the lawyers who are conflicted out because they are witnesses and lawyers who have resigned, he has no lawyers who right now who can take this case to trial. Not only does he need to find competent lawyers, he needs to find competent lawyers with experience in SIPA litigation, the classified information, handling of classified information. And they need, under SIPA, these lawyers need to have security clearances. The lawyers,
really narrows your pool.
It really does. And you know, in Florida,
yeah.
Okay, because these cases typically
members of the Florida bar who have security clearances and want to represent you,
right? And I mean, they I'm sure there are such lawyers, but you know, there are more lawyers of that ilk
here in
per
DC.
Square inch here on K Street
right.
than there are in West Palm Beach or in Miami.
Yeah.
So he's, you know, he's hunting around. And so you've got the problem is that people don't want to take the reputational hit. They don't want to get stiffed on their bills. I mean, it's, you know, good lawyers will not represent him. Truly good lawyers will not represent him. And I learned that back in 2017, he actually was consulting with me in 2017, spring of 2017, about finding lawyers to help with the Mueller investigation. And so many good lawyers were on the list who just didn't want to touch it. Did not, because they knew that he was a bad client. And
it's just like holding a grenade.
Right. Yeah. It's like there's no upside representing. Imagine that. There's no upside to representing a president of the United States who is also a billionaire.
Yeah.
Right? Can you imagine
that's
that? How
insane.
Bad do you have
how
to be?
Bad does it
to,
have to
right.
Be?
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, they're the type of client ordinarily that you, if you are a profit maximizing high end defense lawyer is like, that would be the greatest defense thing to have. Put a feather in your cap to get the guy off.
Steer clear. Yeah. So Parlatori told Axios that after the trial, he predicts the case is going to be appealed to the Supreme Court. He also said like the delays are going to delay. This is not going to be tried within a year. Could be even longer. That puts us right smack dab in the middle of the heat of the 2024 race.
I know that.
How do you expect this to play out, to the Supreme? Okay, let's just say
it's not going to go. It's not going to go to this.
You don't
not,
think so?
I mean, unless nothing has happened thus far, and there is no legal issue that is lurking that would get this case into the Supreme Court.
I mean, okay, we are in uncharted legal territory.
I mean, he's
entitled. Are there going to be novel questions that are raised? Novel legal questions that are raised as part of whether the procedural or substantive prosecution?
No. Because the evidence is so overwhelming and he's not president.
Okay.
He did all this when he was not president and he needs to be treated like everyone else. And he hasn't come up with a factual or legal defense. His construction of the law doesn't make any sense. He's got nothing.
Okay.
He really has nothing. I mean, he'll get.
So contrasted, just for a very brief second, contrasted to the first indictment in New York where there is a really tenuous legal theory about how you get to a federal charge, this is, as procedurally speaking, this is very clear.
I disagree with that characterization of the New York case, and that would be another podcast episode. But there are, you know, at least there are some arguments there that he can make as to whether or not the case, those charges, the books and records charges in New York can be charged as felonies as opposed to misdemeanors. That's the issue.
Right. Right.
Okay. That's the issue. And, it's not, it's a fair ground for litigation. I think the New York District Attorney is correct. Based on what I've read, I haven't done the full research, but I look forward to reading the briefs. There's actual, it's a litigable issue, and I wouldn't be embarrassed to raise it on his behalf if I were representing Donald Trump.
Got it.
He's got nothing here.
Okay.
And he's entitled to one round of appellate review and to say that the evidence is insufficient, but I just don't see how the evidence is not going to be sufficient. Mm-hmm. So he really is behind the eight ball. That said, you know, there's no guarantee that this case gets tried before the election. Yeah. The case should get tried if you had a determined and competent federal judge who doesn't brook any delay and who is methodical and fast. This case could be tried in a year.
Okay.
I think.
Could be. Yeah.
I think a good judge would do that and would want to do that. Because this would be the most important thing on her docket.
You don't want this case because you open just, on election no, day 2024.
Well, it's just disruptive to the court. It's disruptive to the country. And it's not that complicated. It needs to be resolved for everyone's benefit, including Donald Trump's benefit, even though he doesn't want that.
Yeah.
So
he wants this to drag on as long as possible.
Correct. That's what he wants. Every day that he gets a motion that delays that's a day he doesn't spend in federal prison.
Let's turn quickly to how Republican leaders have responded to the indictment. You've got Kevin McCarthy, Lindsey Graham,
shameless and Asa shameful,
Hutchison, Bill Barr, Chris Christie, Mitt Romney. Correct. They don't all fall in the same category.
No,
but it's really hard to take somebody like Chris Christie seriously. Bill Barr, on the other hand.
I'm going to defend
Christie. How do you read all of them? Yeah.
I'm going to defend Christie here. I mean, I take Christie seriously because Christie actually prosecuted cases like this. And he's basically saying, I looked at this indictment. I prosecuted cases like this. And I worked in the Justice Department. And I don't see anything political here. And I think the evidence is overwhelming. There's no reason not to take that at face value. And I think it even has more credibility given the fact that he is a supporter, a past supporter of Trump, and has cut Trump a lot of slack in a lot of ways. You could criticize him for defending Trump at various points for various things.
Things can be true.
It's perfectly okay, in my view, for him to speak the truth about this, and I do think this is more clear cut than anything else that this guy has done.
Yeah.
Okay, I mean, I think the guy was guilty of obstruction in the Mueller investigation. I think the guy was guilty of committing extortion or seeking a bribe in the Ukraine Zelensky conversation. I think he has done a lot of other things. But this is just, as I said, it's like the nickel and dime. It's like the drug bust on the street corner that's filmed from the FBI surveillance car.
Yeah.
Yeah. They got him dead to rights.
Except you don't even need the surveillance car. It's on Twitter. It's out there. He's telling you he's doing it.
He's giving speeches where he's basically admitting that he committed a crime. I mean, this guy, he's like OJ. Did you see that? OJ went on Twitter.
No, I didn't.
OJ went on Twitter a couple of days ago and made this selfie video where he said, listen, I got advice for Donald Trump. Shut up. And, OJ's an expert in this.
Yeah.
Right? OJ knows how to get off a criminal charge where he was, guilty as hell. And I it's good advice. I mean,
it's good advice.
If you're capable of it, no matter how you slice it, so to speak. I shouldn't say that.
I mean, I think, oof, yeah. Oh, that's a hot take.
Okay.
Here's the more depressing part about the Republican response. A recent Yahoo News YouGov poll revealed that 43% of Republican voters believe Trump should be allowed to serve as president even if convicted of a serious
crime. Yeah, no, it's crazy. They literally want their president. They want a president who is a criminal. I mean, just cannot.
Yeah.
The depths to which Trump and the cowardice of people who have allowed Trump to flourish have sunk the Republican Party is just unimaginable. But that's where we are. I mean, we basically have a large segment of
the U.S. voting population that is untethered to and refuses to come to grips with reality. And it's a frightening thing.
This is, regardless of the strength of the case against him, inevitably, inextricably, a test of our democracy.
Correct. It's a test of our ability to apply the laws without fear or favor to everyone.
Yeah. So what is the best case and the worst case? Paint two different pictures here about how this resolves.
Best case is that
for the country. I don't best mean case for in the country. Trump.
Best case.
Sorry about your luck. Believe me, Ron.
I do not look at things from the standpoint of what is best for Donald Trump. But no, the best thing would be for a conviction and incarceration, in my view.
As swiftly
as possible. Now, I don't know whether that's going to happen. I don't think the one outcome I cannot see would be a jury verdict in his favor. I just don't see how he gets 12 jurors to unanimously say that he didn't commit a federal crime.
But they don't need a unanimous conviction here, right?
Yeah, they do.
They do need unanimous.
They need unanimous conviction, but they also need unanimous acquittal. So if it's 11-1 in favor of conviction, and there's this one guy wearing a red hat and a blue Make America Great Again flag on his lapel, and he decides to hang the jury and just not refuse to convict, well, the government gets to try a case again.
They do.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, that would not be a great outcome because this would drag this out to 2025, 2026. But I just don't see him getting off. I mean, theoretically, there's a judge could direct a verdict, the judge, in which case that would have double jeopardy consequences. It couldn't be appealed or couldn't, you know, if she does it on the evidence and doesn't dismiss the case before trial. But the problem is that would be so outrageous. I just can't see how she could rationalize that. I mean, if you're going to take the case and say that there's not enough evidence here, you'd have to take a view of the law that would say that even before the trial, you'd say, well, this indictment, if you accept all the facts as true, doesn't state a crime, in which case you'd have to dismiss the case before trial on a motion to dismiss, if that's what she wants to do, although I think there's no legal basis for it, but that would be appealable. Okay. If she directed a verdict during a trial, then the government's got a problem, and he would walk, I think. But I just don't see how she would do that. And I just, you know, but we'll see. We'll see if she's been chastened by what happened, Judge Eileen Cannon, by what happened when she tried to slow down the government's investigation by appointing a special master, which even Bill Barr said was just bananas.
That's kind of a bonkers ruling. Now, that is, and people will remember that.
Right.
She's the judge trying this case. So in theory, he should be very pleased with this judge.
He got the best possible draw in the nation. Yeah. Absolutely. And it wasn't, you know, it wasn't because there's anything untoward about how she was selected. It's just the fact it was random, but the fact is that because the underlying events occurred in Palm Beach, Florida, the government had to, under the local rules, check a box that said that this case goes to the West Palm Beach division of the court. And in the West Palm Beach division of the court, there are three judges that sit in West Palm Beach. And then there's this one judge, Eileen Cannon, who sits out in Fort Pierce. I guess that's northwest of West Palm. I don't know my Florida geography. Mm-hmm. But they all sit together and hear the West Palm Beach cases. So basically, it's a 1 in 4 chance you draw her. And he got lucky twice. He got 1 in 16. It happens.
So one of the worst case scenarios here is this does drag on until 25, 26. What happens, George, if he, it's going to become the Republican nominee, presumably, DeSantis, nobody else beats him. Then he goes on to face Biden general election 2024. What happens if he beats Biden, then he becomes president again, and he's still...
Well, I think that's a counterfactual. I don't think that's going to come to pass. I mean, my predictions about this were...
Certainly, the chance is not zero.
The chance is not zero, which is, you know, it's kind of like the chance of nuclear war not being zero was always what made us hide in the basements for decades. I mean, you're too young for that.
I don't know. I know my history.
Yeah. You know your history, right? Yeah. You didn't actually go to schools where they had signs that said fallout shelter like they did in the 70s. But okay. Anyway, where was I?
There's a question and a proposition on the table. The question is, what is the worst case scenario that you can think of here that is actually plausible? And I floated one, which doesn't sound great. I don't know if it's the worst, but there is a non-zero chance that he becomes president
Here are my predictions. One is he was going to be indicted two or three times before the election. So that's, I think we may have another federal indictment for the January 6th stuff. Second, he's going to get pretrial release, going to get bail. Third is he's going to foment violence. And fourth is he's going to get the nomination anyway.
Yes. I think all of those things are true.
All those things are true, but I don't think he's going to win the general election. I really don't. But again, as you say, I don't disagree. There is he's on the ballot. There's a non-zero possibility. I mean, you could think of—
Biden's very unpopular. Biden's not that popular,
but I mean, I think people will still crawl on broken glass to vote for him over Trump, even if they don't necessarily approve of Biden. Yeah. And I think he's going to win anyway, but you know, he's old. Maybe he falls off the truck. I don't know. And maybe it's Trump Harris or Trump, somebody else.
Trump Harris. He's
who knows?
Again.
Who knows? Well, yeah. Could be. And then you've got these clowns. I mean, I shouldn't be this mean to them, but
other contenders.
Well, you've got the third party, the no labels. Those people are dangerous. Yeah. Those people are legitimately dangerous because if you have a third party candidate that draws anything away, he's not going to draw from he or she's not going to draw from MAGA. You're going to draw from Biden. And that's, we cannot
have made this case to them.
And the Republicans know this, and the Republicans know, for example, that if somehow DeSantis gets the nomination, they should know by now that Trump is going to run on third party to take DeSantis down. Yeah. I mean, a third party totally would make this a shit show.
A third party presidential ticket would absolutely. Correct. Now, we can set aside another podcast episode for the need of a third party in general.
No,
long-term
viable,
but that's a different thing.
No, that would be really important. Thing.
So, okay. So worst case scenario is...
Worst case scenario.
I know
scenario,
you're an optimist.
The worst case scenario is that the case doesn't get tried before then. The worst case scenario, that's one. The worst case, I don't think there's going to be an acquittal. I just don't see that happening. It could be maybe the judge tries to force one. I don't know. I just don't see that happening. I think the worst case is the case doesn't get tried and before 2024. Before January 1, 2025, and he gets elected, which I think is not going to happen. But if that happens, here's a scenario for you. Okay. Let's say Judge Cannon does everything right and he is convicted in April of 2024.
Okay.
I mean, this is really, really, really speed.
Even the MAGA hat guy votes.
And then, the appeal takes a miraculously short amount of time, or he's remanded to jail pending appeal, and this court. I think the court of let's say his conviction is affirmed. That's the best case scenario, which I think is unlikely to happen in 18 months, and he's in jail.
Okay.
And he's in jail in October of 2024.
Federal prison.
And he's running his campaign, from a payphone. Right. Yeah. Right. From a glass booth, where he's got Jason Miller on the other side of the plexiglass telling him, that's a good ad, run that ad, and he's incarcerated. He wins. They would have to spring him at noon on January 20th, 2025, in my view. I think constitutionally, they would have to spring him. And if, the other thing that he
would try to do.
Like no more or serve out the rest of your sentence after you're done.
I don't think you can incarcerate a sitting president. And, you know, the Justice Department's position has been since the Nixon administration and reaffirmed in the Clinton administration is that you cannot even charge a sitting president of the United States. So there's no question. I mean, I don't know. I don't think that's necessarily right. I think if I were a judge, I wouldn't buy that full position, but I don't see how you could keep the president from being president by holding him in a federal or a state prison. It's just, you know, the executive power resides in him and he's elected president. Then he, you know, no other operation of any other law other than the Constitution can keep him from doing that. And I think the only solution would be for them for Congress to impeach and remove the man. That's what the Constitution provides. So that's the worst case scenario. And then
at that point we are full blown constitutional crisis.
Right? No, we are. Like, no, the country is ungovernable. The country is completely ungovernable. We have basically we are Bolivia.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean that's basically it.
We have lost all credibility.
Have I insulted Bolivia?
On the world
I don't know. Maybe Bolivia is a nice country. I don't know. But you know what I'm saying.
Yes.
And I shouldn't pick
Banana Republic.
I didn't call anybody an asshole country or anything like that. I was just saying. But we would be like a fourth world country if that happens. And that is, you know, the fact that there's even a path to that eventuality
is alarming.
You know, it's like the playoff scenarios. It's like this may be 0.01%, but the fact that it's on the board is absolutely horrifying.
Yeah.
You know, that you even have to draw that path out in your decision tree is terrible.
We won't even get to the rest of these.
No, we could do this for about six more hours.
Yeah, I know.
No, we've been doing it for a while.
But this is good. This is a good walkthrough of where we are now. Mm-hmm. Oh man!
The other thing he would try to do, which I do not know whether he could succeed in, because there's just basically no law in it, and there are good arguments against it, but you know, nothing definitive, is that he could try to pardon himself. The other possibility would be this case drags along. He does not get the nomination, which I don't see how he doesn't get the nomination, because there's just too many people running against him and everybody, the party is so denuded of courage by its leadership that I just don't see.
Yeah. It's 2015 again, except you don't have anybody trying to take.
But the other thing is if he's not elected himself and tries to pardon himself, he could also, he could try to persuade a Republican president who wins in his stead, which I don't see happening, but it could to pardon him. And, I mean, it's just, which would be just a terrible thing for the country. But anyway.
Anything on this front?
Any other horrible thing? Any other horrible scenarios you want to talk about?
I didn't make all this up. Giant meteors.
the big crunch where the theory that astrophysicists reject that says the universe will collapse again into a singularity.
And then Big Bang again.
Yeah. And boom. Bang again. Yeah.
It's just
a
constantly expanding and contracting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it takes 50 billion years, but you know, and it gets a little hot.
By that point, we will all be digitally immortal, because AI will have solved the problem of human consciousness uploading to the cloud.
We will all be like Hal and Frank Bowman in the cloud, 2010.
There's only
the science fiction nuts out there are going to get that.
AI is really going to, I mean, that's...
We're going to be dead by then. Don't worry about it. Okay.
This is happening in the next year. All right, fine.
We're going to save up our money and we're going to take Elon Musk's.
I'd go to space.
Yeah.
I'd do it.
Yeah.
Let's go. Let's do a podcast from space.
Why don't we send Donald Trump there?
Okay.
Donald Trump on Mars. What a real estate play. Look at these. Look at these valleys. Look at those mountains. Oh, little cold. You know, we got to turn up the heat a little.
Oh my God. This is too good. You're still on Twitter, primarily, most of the place. Many places. CNN, MSNBC.
Yeah, I do. I just, you know, I just do whatever.
Okay. And politicology.
Politicology.
We should do a live show, by the way. We're planning on.
You're going to do a live show like on stage?
Yeah, like on stage.
Probably. Yeah, I know. I have some friends who did like the what do they call them? Sisters-in-law.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They
actually,
did a whole thing. Actually, it sounded like it was pretty good. They're great. Well, I love them.
Joyce and Barb and Senator Jones all wanted to join us today, but it was such like last minute. So maybe we should plan a little further out.
But they're fun.
They're really fun.
And people go to these things. It's interesting.
Yes, people go to them.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't get it, but okay.
Especially, yeah. I think our first one.
I'm too lazy to go to stuff.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. I'm too lazy to go to stuff. I just, you know, I even watch the NBA finals on my phone. I don't even go to TV.
But if we put you on stage,
yeah. So. I don't know. I don't think I think I'm bolder here in a studio. Nobody here. Well, I don't see people making faces at me or whatever.
Okay. I know you got corgis to get to.
I do.
We gotta watch today's festivities. Turn on the TV, watch the festivities, pop some popcorn.
Yeah.
George,
Many people are saying this.
Thank you for being
with tears in their eyes.
Let's do this again.
Yep. Thank you.
Bye, Politicology. We'll talk to you soon. Thank you to everyone at home and on the go for listening. If you haven't yet, we'd appreciate it if you could open up the Apple Podcasts app and give us a 5-star rating and review over there. This helps us rise in the rankings so that new people can discover Politicology organically. If you have questions about anything we've talked about, you can reach us, as always, at podcast@politicology.com. And even when we can't respond, we do read everything you send us, whether it's an episode idea, a guest recommendation, or just a simple note about how the show has impacted you. And we love hearing from you. I'm Ron Steslow. I'll see you in the next episode.